This is Patty Daniels. I'm the executive producer of Vermont Edition. We edit our podcast to be shorter and sweeter than what you might have heard on air. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When Governor Phil Scott presented his first budget during his address to the state legislature in late January, he prefaced it with three questions that would guide his actions.
On my first day in office, I directed my entire administration to look at every policy, process, and practice and ask, does it strengthen the economy? Does it help Vermonters keep more of what they earn? And does it protect the most vulnerable?
Well, Governor Phil Scott joins us today, all hour, to discuss how he thinks the budget that was passed by voice vote last week in a special session did in meeting the priorities he laid out in his budget address. So without further ado, let's just get into the conversation. Governor Scott, welcome to the program. It's such a nice pleasure to have you back for the full hour.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Jane.
Overall impressions of the budget, first of all, and then we can get deeper into the legislative session. But are you pleased with the budget that has been passed and that is going to now be implemented in the state of Vermont?
Yeah, I'm very proud of what we accomplished together collectively. When you look back, you go down memory lane a bit. Think about when I took office, was first sworn in, and was immediately hit with a $70 million shortfall in revenues. So we had to build a budget that I said was going to be balanced, live within our means, and also took care of the $70 million challenge that we had. And we produced, and together again, the House came up, followed suit, passed a bill that did not raise taxes and fees, and didn't have everything that I wanted in it. But I was very proud of what they accomplished, and proved that we could do that. And again, towards the end, there was some disagreement about savings in a healthcare plan for school employees. But for the most part, I think that we work well together, and we'll learn from the mistakes of the past and be better for next year. But at the same time, we were able to address those three issues: growing the economy, making Vermont more affordable, and taking care of the most vulnerable. And we did that with this budget.
You said you think you worked well with the legislature. How would you characterize that relationship?
Well, it's new, to be quite honest. We were all new to our positions. And it's a new dynamic.
Yeah, this is just to recap for people who don't remember. This was the first time there was a new Speaker of the House. There was a new Senate President Pro Tem. There was a new Lieutenant Governor and a new Governor. So in those leadership positions, it was all people who were tackling this for the first time.
That's right. And again, a different dynamic when you consider that not all of one party. And that's what was a bit of the different dynamic. And there's always, you know, over the last 16 years, 17 years that I've been involved in public service and in the legislature in particular, I think back about all the scrums that took place somewhat. There was always that dynamic of either the House versus the Senate or the legislature versus the administration. And that was as true this year as ever. But figuring out what everybody's strengths and weaknesses were, different styles, takes a little bit of time. And for the most part, again, while I know we had a little bit of a hiccup at the end, by the time we sign, you know, we're going to be signing the bill tomorrow, as a matter of fact, we'll have something that all of us can be proud of. And again, we treated each other with respect and civility, and I think that should be set the tone for the way we should be doing business throughout our country. As a matter of fact, we can disagree about the issues, but if we listen to each other and respect our each other and our positions, we can get through most anything.
Let's go to Jackson, calling in from Orange. Hi, Jackson. Go right ahead.
Hi, Governor Scott.
Good afternoon.
Glad to see you still racing up the Denver Road. The only governor in the country who isn't a stop there. Anyway, I just want to give you two thumbs up for what most people probably don't even know about. You signed a media shield law for freedom of the press, so journalists won't go to jail if they don't reveal confidential sources. So that way they can interview more people and do their job better. So thank you very much for that media shield law. And then another law you did was protecting senior citizens more from predation in different ways. You can explain more about that if you wish to, but you also did that. And this is the stuff that's not headlines in the paper, and I thank you very much for those two ads.
So, Jackson, thanks for your call. Your line was really difficult to hear. So let me just recap for people who might have had a little bit of trouble understanding Jackson. He wanted to say kudos to the governor for passing the Media Shield law to protect journalists and their sources. And then he also said thank you for protecting senior citizens from fraud and was hoping you might speak a little bit more about that.
On both counts, fall into that category of protecting the most vulnerable. And
Journalists don't think of ourselves as the most vulnerable.
No, I don't usually, but I think about the people that come forward and offer information. Those are, I think, that's when I was referring to the most vulnerable. I think it was more the people that came forward with information, because they should be, they should do so without fear of retribution. And
it also does protect journalists from going to jail for protecting their sources.
That's right. That's right. And protects those sources.
That's right.
So I think what we want is we need more transparency, more freedom of the press, to make sure that everything gets out. And if somebody feels as though they're going to be, they're intimidated by the fact that they may be exposed in some way, I don't think we'd have as many people coming forward. And that's across the board. So we need more than ever, I believe, that because of the changing dynamics in social media and the way we receive our information, we need more people coming forward to tell the real story. We need to figure out what's real and what's not, and make sure that that we pay attention. So it's going to be a lot of pressure on a changing market for you, as a matter of fact. And so we have to work our way through that. So protecting them, I think, is important. Protecting the media as well as those sources was important. And it wasn't full transparency. It wasn't my initiative.
That's right.
It was the initiative of the legislature. And but I believe that, and it was advocated by the media, and they worked hard trying to get to a conclusion on that. But we all agreed that it was something that we wanted to move forward with and to finally signed into law. The other issue that Jackson brought up was protecting, again, another vulnerable sector, and that's our more senior citizens. And I think that as we look at Vermont, and something I talk about a lot is that we have an aging demographic, and that's part of our problem, part of our challenge. But at the same time, we have an obligation to make sure that we protect them. So once again, coming together, legislature, the attorney general, and the administration, all finding a common goal where we can work together, I think we can get some we can get positive results. And that's what another example of what we've done to accomplish that.
Let's talk a little bit about a compromise that took a little bit longer to come to, and it really sparked this special session, this veto session, and that's the budget. But specifically, let's talk a little bit about the teacher health care plan that was sort of the stopping block for the budget. This was a debate over how teacher health care plans should be negotiated. Currently, the contracts are negotiated, including health care, at the local level. You had said you wanted to have a statewide teacher health care contract. And the legislature balked. They said they didn't get enough time from you on that issue. They're not opposed to it in principle, legislative leaders said, but opposed to doing it this fast right now. And had tried to come up with some compromises, but nothing quite worked for you before the end of the session. You did veto the budget because of that. I want to bring you back to your budget address in January, and then we'll go forward to June. But here's a little bit of what you said in your budget address.
I'm proposing parity in what teachers and state employees contribute toward the cost of their health care. State employees currently pay 20% of their health care premiums, and most private sector workers pay even more. By comparison, teachers currently pay about 15%. By establishing parity amongst these public employees, asking everyone to pay 20%, we can generate $15 million in savings per year. And with most teachers' contracts expiring on June 30th, I will seek legislation requiring new contracts include this change.
So that's from January, from your budget address. That's not quite the same thing as saying that you would like to see a statewide teacher contract. And here's an email that we got from Addison County Senator Chris Bray, who says, I think one of the most dramatic differences and the biggest challenges of this administration has been failing to lead. And I mean that respectfully and literally. The legislature actually counts on every administration to bring forward much more than ideas. We count on them to bring forward real proposals. When an administration doesn't, it creates a power vacuum that leads to difficulties. Best case in point, Governor Scott's proposal to take school employees' health care benefits out of local contracts. This idea was controversial, so much so that the governor literally vetoed a budget that was passed 173-1 to press his position. Surely it was, therefore, a very major proposal on the governor's part, and yet it was not presented in writing until the last Friday in April. That is failing to lead, and that failure led to 7 weeks of turmoil and expense, including another week in session in May and then a special veto session. That's the leadership problem.
Well, I have a great deal of respect for Senator Bray, but what he's saying there is just not factual at all. And I think that if he looks back at how this came to be, I think we'll have to go down memory lane a bit. We can go back a couple of years. This first of all, this whole initiative on this VHI proposal was because of the Affordable Care Act. This was something that was known for a couple of years. In fact, VHI, who is the neutral administrator of these new health care plans, is made up of both the School Board Association, and they have someone from the NEA on the board as well, working towards a conclusion, adopting these plans. They came before the legislature in years past, like a year or two ago, and talked about these plans with the legislature. It fell on somewhat deaf ears. They didn't act. They didn't prepare. But they talked about the potential savings with these plans. So when I came forward with my budget, and so here's the leadership issue, I said I made mention of that in my budget address, and
that contracts were due re-upping.
Well, that we should have some parity, uniformity. That I believe that school employees and teachers should be paying 20%. That was met with a bit of resistance from both the School Board Association, the Superintendents Association, the legislature in general. They didn't think highly of that plan. So the lack of leadership part, it just wasn't what they wanted to hear. So they didn't take up the issue in the Senate or the House. They didn't give it any effort at all. So that's when, again, the School Board Association and the superintendents weren't happy with my proposal, but they came forward and said, well, wait a minute. Here's something we can agree to. Here's something we've been working on, which I wasn't aware of. So they came forward with this other proposal, this 80-20 split, fairly similar, but described how we could have some savings, that if we'd have $75 million worth of savings, we could take $50 million of that. We could reinvest it in teachers and employees to make sure that they're held harmless. And we could recoup about $25 million worth of savings for the state coffers. So I thought that sounded like a good idea. I brought it forward. I spoke to the House and Senate leadership about this issue back in January, February, asked them if they would push this forward. So we had discussions about who was going to go forward with this initially.
Well, what did they tell you? Well, I mean, why not put a proposal
then? They thought it was a good idea. But, you know, again, I was coming off a very stinging loss on this 80-20 split where the legislature wanted no part of it. And I thought that maybe what we should do is take a different approach. And I would support whatever they came forward with. In fact, in many of the press conferences after that, in February, March, if you go back and take a look, I was asked about what my plan B was. I talked about VHI. I said, well, there's all
kinds. And again,
VHI
is the Vermont Education Health Initiative.
That's right. And that neutral body, the administrator that was put into place to transition to these new plans, because regardless of who came into office, these were going to take place.
Right.
Because
all the plans had to be renegotiated.
Yeah, the Cadillac tax and so forth that the Affordable Care Act was going to impose on these type of plans. So they had to transition to something else, and they were fully prepared to do so. I just wanted to make sure that they did it on a uniform basis. And doing so on a statewide basis with one negotiation, I thought made some sense. So everyone had the same thing. So school boards could then go back and negotiate with the union in terms of salaries and vacations and curriculum and so forth and so on. Still have that negotiating tool, but take away the very complicated healthcare side of things, and everyone have the same plan. That was what I envisioned. There was a pushback from the NEA because of collective bargaining. They thought it was an infringement upon collective bargaining. I didn't want to infringe upon that, so we are looking for other opportunities to work around that. Towards the end of the session, again, when nobody was moving forward with these plans, I thought it necessary to do so. We had the Beck Amendment on the House floor, which actually passed. And then was the speaker decided to vote and made it a tie, which negated that that amendment. So that to say that we didn't, this was last minute, I would beg to differ. This is
in retrospect. Do you wish you had put it in writing in January?
Well, had I known about this VHI proposal that the legislature knew about, that they had gone and testified in different committees, had I known about this to begin with, I may have put their plan in place instead of my 80-20 split and frozen some of the school boards or the budgets in the districts. I probably would have taken a different approach, but that's not the case. I didn't know about it, but I learned quickly, and so I was just looking for an opportunity to move this thing forward. So that we could have something we could all come together and move forward on.
So what happened, though, in the veto session was that in June, you and lawmakers got together and hammered out a deal that you could all agree on. And it basically now leaves it up to school districts to find $13 million in savings over the next 2 years. And these contracts are due, as we heard in the address earlier, June 30th. And in fact, many of them, a third of them, have already been agreed upon. Now it looks like many districts are worried that they're not going to be able to find the savings in healthcare contracts that you and the legislature have suggested. And that is going to mean rapid cuts in other places. Let me just play you. Here's what Lamoille South Supervisory Union Superintendent Tracy Rend said just after the deal was reached last week.
What has been unsettling has been just the last couple of days of conversations behind closed doors that resulted in a proposal that we have not had time to evaluate, vet, analyze, give thoughtful and thorough feedback to.
So how is what you and lawmakers came up with a good solution if it basically throws it at the feet of school districts now?
Well, there are guideposts that we had envisioned. There's benchmarks along the way in trying to funnel more of these budget negotiations to this 80-20 split, this VHI proposal. I would have rather had instituted the plan in general and just put it into either law or negotiate on a statewide basis, one of the two. But this is a compromise that we had to work out. We were getting close to something of this nature towards the end of the first part of the session before I vetoed the budget. And we might have, maybe another day or so, we might have come to the same conclusion. But at the same time, in the end, I think we all had to give something. It's not a perfect solution, but there are savings out there regardless. I mean, $75 million worth of savings are out there somewhere. So those who have negotiated, they're utilizing savings somewhere in their budget. So the challenge, I don't mean to diminish how difficult this is for those who have ratified. I think there were 11 or 12 that had ratified by the time the budget was finally negotiated, or the our budget. I don't want to underestimate how difficult this is going to be on those, and that's That's unfortunate. Again, I wish we would have been able to come to a conclusion earlier and instituted some sort of a statewide initiative where everyone had the same thing so that everyone would have known going into their negotiations that this would have been differently. Now, there are going to be – there's another opportunity within the bill. We are going to reopen these contracts again in about a year and a half or so in 19, fiscal year 19. So that we can see if there's mistakes made. There's a commission that's going to take a look at whether there should be a statewide health care contract. And if so, there's an opportunity to institute that when we reopen these health care contracts again in a year and a half or so.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we are asking Phil Scott all about the legislative session and how it went, how he feels about it, victories, compromises, how his relationship with the legislature has changed over time, and especially now that he sits in the top office. And we're also talking about specific issues like teacher health care contracts, legalizing marijuana. We're going to talk about other things that are important to you as well. Susanna is calling in from East Callis. Hi, Susanna. Go right ahead.
Governor Scott, first of all, thank you so much for taking on the health care issue. It's daunting. I'm a school board member and have been working with this issue for about 2 years now. Have you considered grandfathering in those supervisory unions that already ratified?
Actually, we did in our initial discussions. I had advocated that we'd hold them harmless and not bring them into the fray. But during the negotiation, the legislature decided they wanted to include them. And there were all kinds of reasons to make sure there's equity amongst those who have already ratified. But initially, we did. I'd advocated for holding them harmless, not bringing them in, and honoring their agreements. And I would have done that had we gone to a statewide health care contract. Or if we put the 80-20 $400 out of pocket costs into a statute, I would have advocated at that point to make sure that we didn't include them. But because of the conclusion we finally arrived at, it was necessary to include the others, which is unfortunate.
You know, one of the things that has come up since the session and that people have been frustrated with is that there was a feeling that the negotiations, the compromise, was done sort of in secret, that you and legislative leaders were working behind the scenes, not being very open. And there is a lot of lip service paid to transparency and open negotiations and taking all perspectives into account. And it didn't feel like that to many people who were trying to figure out what is happening with this special session, both before and during it. What do you think about that, given that, you know, this is a criticism that people have, that this was done behind the scenes? This is not the way lawmaking is supposed to work.
I will say the area of disagreement was very narrow. So for those who have said that there wasn't they didn't know what was going to be spoken about or negotiated. I would say all of this was out in the open to begin with. We had put some conditions initially. We were trying to negotiate exactly how we were going to negotiate, if that makes any sense at all. And we had put forward at one point that we would just as soon do it out in the open and have it in a style that's somewhat similar to the legislative process, where you have three on each side and you do so in a transparent, open process. But that was met with a little resistance. And again, I think some wanted to be more candid and wanted to be able to advocate different thoughts and ideas without doing so in public. So we took that approach. We all went in together and decided to try and come to some conclusion. We wanted to make sure that we did so. As I advocated for, again, it wasn't the greatest negotiating tactic, but as you might recall, after I vetoed the budget, I was immediately hit with, well, you're trying to shut down government because the fiscal year ends at the end of June, and we're going to go into a possibility of going into a new year. And that was used as a lot of rhetoric, even after I said we aren't going to shut down government. I will not allow that to happen. We are going to have a budget, even if that means that I have to give. And because I think that we aren't Washington, we aren't D.C., we don't shut down governments. We want to make sure that everyone has some sense of normalcy. And so, again, I had made that remark a number of times that we would move forward and sign something before the end of the month.
Let's move on and talk about another big issue, and again, one that came up during the special veto session that's left supporters very frustrated, and this was the legalization of marijuana. You had said when you vetoed the marijuana bill that if there certain changes were made, you would be willing to sign it, that you were not philosophically opposed to legalization completely, but there were things that you wanted to see, including bigger safety measures and more study. We've gotten a lot of emailed comments and questions, and we have some phone calls about marijuana. So let me just read you a few, and then we can talk about it. Jamie in Sag Harbor, New York says, I'd like to know what's your logic behind anti-legalization when the state is desperate for funds to improve schools, roads, and bridges, not to mention the prescription opioid crisis fueling so many robberies and other crimes, again, without proper funding to combat the problem. Colorado has so much tax revenue coming in, they quite literally don't know how to spend all of it, and they're now giving out tax credits, and this is from a plant, just like tobacco. Justin in St. Albans says, with budget shortfalls and a tourist economy, why do you refuse to work with cannabis legalizations as an option? Your carefully crafted political responses, no one is going to argue with child safety, yet it's not, quote, one of your priorities. $13 million from school budgets is more harmful than taxable cannabis income. I hope you enjoy your single term, Governor. Bill in Springfield says, Governor, if you support legalizing marijuana, why didn't you lean on the Republican caucus to support the marijuana legalization? And on that note, Rama in Williamstown said, Governor Scott, you stated publicly that in the case of the marijuana bill, you would advocate for the Republican caucus to agree to the rules change so it could reach your desk and get signed, should you and the General Assembly reach agreement. In your own words, you did reach agreement and come up with a bill you would sign, but you reneged on your promise to advocate for a rules suspension in the House. What are you going to do to begin the extremely long trek of re-earning folks' trust in your word? So this was the problem with the marijuana legalization bill, was that there would need to be a suspension of rules to get it passed during the veto session. And what Rama is saying is that you had said, yeah, I'll tell the Republicans to go along with this.
I think you better go back and go back to those sound bites and take the full response of what I said when I was asked about this. And I think Rama took something out of context. And if you read the full statement, you won't come to that conclusion.
That was the conclusion I came to, though, in reading back on the VPR stories, was that you said you would support a rules change.
I'll show you exactly. We took it out, and I can give you verbatim what I said.
And what did you say?
Well, I said that that it was totally up to the House. There was a couple of times that this issue came up. And I said that if we came to some conclusion where they met my conditions, that I would support and pass and sign the legislation. And when asked about the House and whether they were going to pass, I said at different points something to the effect that it was up to them. I wasn't going to twist arms, that they were going to do what they were going to do. I didn't have power over them. They're independently elected as well. And but I would advocate my position and let them do what they were going to do.
I guess that's the question that people have: is what does advocate your position mean when it comes to talking to the Republican caucus?
I wanted to make sure that they knew that this agreement where they had met my conditions in terms of this commission that I think is so important. That as passed, it didn't make a lot of sense. It was six legislators, I think, and maybe the ag secretary. And
this was to study the commercial
to go into a regulatory market. And I thought at that time there were so many other people that should be at the table. I think we figured out how to grow it. I don't think that was the problem. I think the ag secretary was just one piece of that. I think we needed somebody from commerce and tax and public safety and education and so forth. So they met my conditions in terms of the commission. There was some other elements that that I thought were very important. Extending the timeline, they had a very tight, like a 3 or 4 month time frame, in order to come forward with a complete legislation to move forward with the regulatory system. I think it should take as long as it needs to. I think it should extend to a year. And I would say, I would advocate that let's work on first, let's work on highway impairment. How do we keep our kids safe? And what do we do to protect the general public? If we're going to do this, let's do it right. We have time to do it. Throughout the campaign, I said, I'm not saying never. I'm saying not now. I'm saying that we have other priorities, and this shouldn't be about money. I said that numerous times. Because the more states who do legalize, the less money is going to be available. And I know that some would say that Colorado is reaping the benefits from this, and they probably are, but they were one of the first to legalize. So there are many who are going there just for that. But as other states legalize, it somewhat waters that down a bit. So we negotiated in good faith on this agreement. I will say that this isn't dead. That's what I think is being lost amongst many. This is just on this piece of legislation. This bill is just on sabbatical. It's just on summer vacation. It will, without a rules suspension, it will come to the House floor almost on the first day. So it will be there waiting. And so this isn't over. It's just taking a bit of a breather. And so this will come up again. This didn't, the legislation didn't have any legalization until July of 2018. And that hasn't come to bear yet. That's still there. We'll move forward with some sort of commission. I've said that I want to, regardless of what happens here, we still have an issue with highway impairment, and we need to address that. So, and we want to protect our kids. So I'll develop an executive order that will address this commission that will come to the legislature with some thoughts about how we can do that as we move to the next step. So I don't think there's any time that's been lost at all in some respects.
I guess I don't understand your strategy then, or the thinking on telling lawmakers, if you make these changes, I'll pass it now, even though that's going to require some rules suspensions, which the Republican caucus is not likely to go for. Why not let's do it next year?
Yeah, but I didn't even think about the rules suspension piece, but I mean, to be honest with you. I mean, that didn't enter my mind when I said, when I vetoed the bill, and I said that if you meet these conditions, that I will sign this, will sign the bill. We can take this up in June. I wasn't thinking about a rule suspension or that could hold up the process. It didn't even enter my mind at all.
And nobody on your staff said, hey, Governor, that's going to require your caucus to have to do some fancy footwork that it doesn't want to do.
They could have done some other things. If there had been a real push to do this, they could have put it in the budget. It could have happened. There's all kinds of ways for this to
heads would have
happen.
Exploded if they put marijuana in the budget.
But think about this as well. This wasn't just a Republican issue. This wasn't just a minority issue. There were 5 Republicans that voted the other way. There were 14 Democrats that voted no. So it could have, if leadership really wanted this, if they really wanted to make a push on this, they would have maybe leaned on the 14 Democrats that voted no. You know, it could have happened regardless, or they could have even overturned my veto had there been a push to do so. So I think everyone is somewhat comfortable. I know the advocates are disappointed. But this doesn't go away again. This is going to have another day, live for another day, and it'll be right there waiting for us in January. And you won't have to go through another lengthy vote and negotiation. It'll be there to determine whatever they decide to do, they can do on the first day of the session.
Okay, listeners, I promise this is not the end of our conversation about marijuana legalization either, but let's put a pin in this part of the conversation for now. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We've been talking with Governor Phil Scott about the budget, teacher health care, marijuana. A listener posting as Over the Edge says, Governor Scott has publicly said he opposes the Republican health care proposal in the U.S. Senate, that it would be bad for Vermonters. But is he actually doing anything to convince Republican senators to oppose the legislation? Has he called or met with senators to explain to them why he thinks the bill is a bad thing and asking them to oppose it? Has he written to senators? Has he signed on to bipartisan letters from other governors calling on the Senate to reject it? Has he spoken with the national press about why a Republican governor opposes the bill? He being you.
Yes. to all the above. You know, I've been clear since this initiative took place in the House. I've been clear. I've said publicly and in direct communications with our congressional delegation and other governors, federal partners, that while reforms are needed in the Affordable Care Act, we must not roll back the progress that Vermont has made. I'm very proud of what we've done and here in the state, and we should maintain those coverage gains that we've made. I wrote back in January, I sent a letter to the U.S. House Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, calling on leadership to make sure that we boost, not undermine, progress made and keep the expanded coverage many states have achieved. I think over half the states have expanded Medicaid, and Vermont being one. And we, you know, the reality is we rely heavily on federal funding. Almost half our budget is based on federal funding. So just a small change in Washington has a dramatic effect on us. So as instituted, this change that's being advocated, even on the Senate level, which the Senate's a little bit better than the House, but not a lot, would have a devastating effect on Vermont. We will.
So how much are you leaning on your Republican colleagues around the country?
I've been in contact with many, many Republican governors. We wrote a letter this week to the leadership, Senator Schumer, as well as Senator
McConnell.
McConnell, I'm sorry. And ask
because Schumer says Schumer's with you, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so we've reached out to other governors, other senators throughout the U.S. To advocate for our position. Just take the time necessary. There's no rush to do this, and the unintended consequences of this on some of these states, ourselves included, and many others, and led by both Republicans and Democrats. We've been working with the National Governors Association. We've signed on the letters with them. We've taken positions across the board in advocating our position, and we'll continue to do so to make sure that, and again, working with our congressional delegation, with Senator Leahy and Congressman Welch, and as well Senator Sanders, we're doing whatever we can to protect our state.
A couple of quick questions about policy calls that have come out from other elected offices in the state of Vermont or other issues. Secretary of State Jim Condos has been now calling for an ombudsman position for the state to help private citizens access open records and to assist organizations around the state to comply with open meetings and open records laws. Do you think that's a good idea?
I don't think it's a bad idea at all. I think it's appropriate for the Secretary of State to advocate for that position. I think he probably could do that under his guidance right within the Secretary of State's office.
So you think he can make that happen?
He
doesn't need anybody.
I would think he could.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Two new reports out from Auditor Doug Hoffer's office say that the state needs to do better in keeping records, again with the records, explaining its decisions when it comes to personnel matters relating to discipline or HR investigations. The auditor's office looked at about 120 cases from several different government agencies, including the Agency of Human Services and the Agency of Transportation, and says, look, records aren't being kept clearly enough, and decisions aren't being delineated when there is discipline or when someone is exonerated in an HR investigation. What are your thoughts on that?
I thought it was a well-written report. This was a report that was done on the previous administration, and I thought that some of the suggestions make sense, and we'll be implementing some of those. We want to make sure that we protect and invest wisely in the limited resources we have. $3 million, I think, was the figure that the auditor had had utilized. And again, we need to do whatever we can to save those resources. So we'll be taking his suggestions and implementing them as we speak.
I would like to ask you a little bit about what you're feeling now, almost 6 months into your first term. And so I'll admit to you, one of the frustrations that I've had with you over the years in chatting with you, especially in your terms as lieutenant governor, is that it was really hard to pin you down on a topic. And it felt like you're very deliberative. And you'd often say, you know, I need to look at that. I need to think about it. We should take some time. And as a journalist, you know, you always want to say, right, but what's your position? And now I think that was really strategic of you because, you know, you as lieutenant governor, a position with not a lot of power, you put yourself in a position to be out there in the public sphere, to be learning about Vermonters, to be doing your jobs tour, but not necessarily to be able to be nailed down to a certain position that might hurt you now as governor. And now as governor, you are taking positions. You say, here are my boundaries. You've said to the legislature in more than one occasion, this is what I need from you if you want to get agreement from me. So have you had a change or you know, was this sort of strategy that went a decade back?
No strategy from a decade back. You play the cards you dealt. And when you're lieutenant governor, as I learned over the 6 years I was lieutenant governor, you don't have a lot of power. I mean, the only constitutional duties you have are to preside over the Senate and make sure you're there prepared, ready to take over if something should happen to the governor. Which I worked along throughout my political career, trying to find compromise, trying to agree on goals, and tried to do so in a bipartisan, tripartisan manner. And I think that's important, that we're all in this together. And if we can find areas of agreement, that we can take our different approaches. But if we can end up getting the goal, I think that's the most important factor. And we did that with this budget. Throughout all the end, theatrics at the end, we had a budget that is going to protects the most vulnerable and makes investments in areas of the economy, something I've been speaking about for 6 or 7 years, that we need to make those precious investments in order to reverse these trends that we're seeing. The, you know, 6 fewer workers in our workforce every single day, 3 fewer kids in our schools every single day, 1 baby born to an addiction every single day. We need to reverse those numbers, and you have to make investments in order to do so.
Yeah, good. I understand. But were you saying 6 years ago, were you biting your tongue when Governor Shumlin would come out with a policy that you said, oh, no, this is what we should be doing? And you know, you wound up being maybe the most well-liked politician in the state of Vermont. And now you're the governor, and now you have the ability to make these policy choices, and you're doing it.
Yeah. Well, 6 years ago, I didn't have any inkling that I was going to run for governor. It wasn't something that was on my trajectory. It wasn't something I was really that interested in, to be honest. But the lack of effort in trying to focus on the issues that we face, and something that I learned along those 6 years with that everyday jobs thing tour, going out and speaking to Vermonters, just really figuring out what's the problem with Vermont, and a lack of focus in those areas of economic opportunity were what drove me to run for governor. And so I'm using everything I've learned over the last 16 years to my full advantage, but at the same time, treating each other with respect and civility, and listening to other ideas, and knowing that we don't have all the ideas, but being clear about what the expectations are.
Has separating yourself from your company been painful for you?
Well, I haven't had time to really, you know, in retrospect, I would. It's been difficult in some respects, but at the same time, I'm fully immersed in what I'm doing. I work, you know, I keep the same hours that I kept when I was in the construction business, and we have a lot to do in the state, and so that would have been a distraction. It's probably better that it worked out the way it did.
Well, Governor Phil Scott, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you very much, Jane.